Good afternoon. It's 12:06 and time for Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. I'm your host, Sarah D'Elia. On today's show, we're dedicating the whole hour to PTSD, how it pertains to veterans, specifically how post-traumatic stress disorder is a moral injury. If you'd like to join today's conversation, give us a call at 260-452-1185, email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm, or post any questions or comments on our Midday Matters Facebook page. Joined in the studio today, I have my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, who's going to introduce the topic and our guests.
Thank you, Sarah. Today we will be discussing PTSD and moral injury in returning combat veterans and how combat trauma can cause long-lasting moral injury and post-traumatic stress disorder and the undoing of the combat soldier's character. While our society is still dealing with the many Vietnam veterans still suffering from PTSD and moral injury 40 years after that conflict ended, we are now dealing with 30 to 50% of returning Iraq and Afghanistan veterans with significant mental health issues, including PTSD, and a very high and increasing rate of suicide among this population. Here to define and discuss the causes, symptoms, long-term consequences, and treatment of moral injury and PTSD are Dr. Bruce Nirenberg, psychologist at the PTSD program at our local VA hospital with 11 years of experience treating PTSD veterans, and licensed clinical social worker Dan Bishton, clinical therapist in the VA PTSD program, and currently caregiver support case manager for the spouses and families of disabled veterans, many of whom have PTSD. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to start out asking Dr. Nirenberg, what are the definitions and causes of moral injury and PTSD?
Well, moral injury for me was first brought up by Dr. Shea in his book, Achilles in Vietnam, Combat Trauma and the Undoing of Character. For me, moral injury is an injury to one's character. Aristotle talked about how everything in nature has a proper place, except for humans who have rationality and can choose their place. We have to make our own place in nature. So we don't have a habitat. We live in habits, which become our character. So these repeated actions form our character. In court, they talk about character witnesses. What happens in combat is that character is undone. Aristotle referred to character as ethike, the proper place where we live is ethos. It's a ethical or moral injury when we injure character. And character injury happens not only when we experience things beyond what one should experience in a life, mm-hmm. or do beyond something beyond the experience, but when we're also betrayed by somebody who does not do what's right, and we get involved in that.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, Lieutenant, I forget his first name. He wrote a book about on killing, and he was a soldier, and talked about how difficult it is for the military to change a civilian, a citizen who's been raised to be honorable and to do the right thing and to help people and to take pity on children and animals and be a good person, and then they have to turn that person into a person who is willing to to kill other people. There was a recognition in the military that in World War II, for example, they did some studies that showed that a great many men could not and did not fire their weapons mm-hmm. in combat. And so they set about correcting that in the Korean War and the Vietnam War and in this one, when they gave them many, many, many messages that you have to be able to do that. Mm-hmm.
The book on killing was, I think, Lieutenant Colonel David Grossman.
Yeah, that's right.
And that is exactly how an individual is manipulated. Their character is changed. In World War II, 15% of infantry fired their weapons, 20%. They trained their accuracy on bullseyes. They found that didn't work. So in Vietnam, they used shapes of people. deconditioning individuals with regard to shooting at people, or they use pop-ups shaped like people. Mm-hmm. So it deconditioned purposely people, soldiers, so that they could fire at people and not think anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Before we get too involved into today's conversation, I'm sure some of our listeners would rightfully point out that there are many different types of PTSD, and not just people who have served time in the military or any armed forces. So, Dr. Nuremberg, I was hoping that you could define specifically the type of PTSD we're going to be talking about during this hour and how it might differentiate from somebody who experienced a different traumatic experience but wasn't serving any time.
In general, one of the characteristics I hear from people who have been traumatized, and I think that PTSD may evolve, is when they say, that was surreal, it was unreal, because then they're making it not part of their lives. It becomes out there, almost like they want to deny it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very important part of PTSD. But what we're dealing with is combat PTSD. Combat PTSD is complex because not only did the soldier suffer, or Marine, suffer injury, horrific events, buddies being killed, exploded, but also they perpetrated a lot of violence. Not only did they kill to win, but in a firefight, in killing the enemy and getting revenge, there's nothing better. There's no adrenaline high that they will ever experience again that's better. So how does a combat veteran say, you know, best time I had in my life was killing people? And they took pleasure in it. And what kind of person am I if I took pleasure in it? So I took pleasure in doing this. But, you know, I did it because they killed my buddy. So now I have the trauma of suffering the losses and doing the bad things. And one reminds me of the other. It goes back and forth. If I think of what I did, I'm reminded why I did it. If I think of what happened to me, I'm reminded of how I got even.
You know, a soldier recently told me something about his experience in Afghanistan. He said it was like 24 hours or 23 hours and 30 minutes of boredom, followed by with 30 minutes maybe of sheer terror, you know, in any given day, that, you know, or even less time, but that this can be, you know, nothing's going on and then suddenly it's life and death going on, you know, your survival. And there's an exhilaration that, you know, not everybody necessarily, they're confused sometimes afterwards. A bunch of explosions go off and they've survived. They've fought back, they've killed the enemy, and they're still standing there. And there's a triumph that they can feel about that, that later they might feel bad about. They could feel a whole bunch of different things at that moment, and it's too difficult to process in the middle of the battlefield. You have to put that aside. I'll think about that later. I'll think about that later, and then
or it doesn't mean anything,
right?
We need to take a quick break here on Health 360 on WBOY, but we'll be back. We're talking today, we're dedicating a whole hour on PTSD, how it pertains to veterans. If you have any questions or comments, 260-452-1185 is the number to call. You can always post any questions or comments on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or send us an email, middaymatters@nipr.fm.
Living with severe mental illness can be a full-time job. Sufferers may endure overwhelming delusions and hallucinations. Too often, hospitalizations, treatment, and medications can put careers out of reach. Still, some of the mentally ill make it work and live remarkably successful lives. I'm Neil Conan, managing mental illness, medication, and work. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tune in weekdays at 2 here on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
You help pay for public education in Indiana, but from the Capitol to the classroom, the payback isn't always clear. You can find out how the state's policy impacts your family in our new State Impact Indiana Project, a local national collaboration between Indiana public broadcasting stations and NPR. You can hear the stories during Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Weekend Edition on NIPR, and dig deeper with a click on the State Impact logo at nipr.fm.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Unitarian Universalist Congregation, sponsoring the Art Venture Chicago bus trip, Saturday, March 9th. Reservation deadline, Monday, February 4th. Details at uufortwayne.org. Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Cameron Memorial Community Hospital, providing health and wellness services in the spirit of charity, concern, and excellence, serving Steuben County and surrounding areas. Information at CameronMCH.com. Welcome back to Health 360 here on WBOI. The time is 12:18. We'd love to hear from you today. 260-452-1185 is the number to call. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio today with Dr. Bruce Nuremberg. He's the head of the PTSD program here in Fort Wayne at the Veterans Hospital, and Dan Bishton, who is also a counselor and therapist at the VA Hospital. And of course, I have my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman.
Just as we were just mentioning the differences between civilian and combat PTSD, it must be kept in mind that combat PTSD is often related to an individual having killed or witnessed killing, and also witnessing the killing of civilians by mistake. And while in PTSD, in a general sense, may be based on what was done to an individual, the PTSD that these combat veterans seem to have is what they did or witnessed doing, and they end up with a persistent grief, guilt, sadness, and remorse as part of the moral injury. One quarter of vets seem to have alcohol problems, one-third depressed. They feel like they, quote, lost their soul, the undoing of character, as Dr. Nuremberg has described. This is a long-lasting, persistent problem. What are the long-term effects on these individuals, and how does it affect their reintegration into society, into their families, into the workplace?
Just to preface that, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is not really a disorder, and Dr. Shea makes this point very clear. If somebody came home and they had lost an arm in battle, we don't call it missing arm disorder. It's an injury, and it can have subsequent flare-ups and cause all kinds of problems down the road. It should be post-traumatic stress injury, but not just stress, because that's anxiety. He says, like you indicated, post-traumatic substance abuse injury, post-traumatic depression injury. The emotions are injured. They're machine gunned. And a lot of times veterans can't see that. A lot of veterans who have a wound sometimes can at least relate to it. But if nothing else happened, then you just have these problems. It's hard to get a grasp of it for a veteran, but it's an injury. And the injury takes the form of they can't sleep. They are hyper alert. They're aware of everything going on around them. They walk into a restaurant and they have to sit at a booth, nobody behind them, facing the door. So they have to be hyper-vigilant. They have this extreme startle response. Touch one on the back and you might get clobbered. They have problems concentrating. Well, and they look like they have attention deficit disorder. Well, yeah, maybe they do, but maybe they don't. Maybe they're so concerned with what's going on around them, they can't pay attention to what's in front of them. They also show a lot of anxiety. They can use substances to hide it, cover it up.
Calm themselves down, yeah.
Calm themselves down. One of the characteristics is high-risk behaviors. They love to do something that will try to get back that feeling that they had, that adrenaline rush. So they come back and do these all race cars, motorcycles. They love that kind of high-risk behavior. They're also, they work all the time. If you ask a combat vet how long do they work, well, 80-hour week, 90-hour week, because it does two things. It helps them not think about what these intrusive images or thoughts. And second of all, they get to prove themselves, because the Vietnam vets were rejected when they came home. They didn't assume their traditional patriarchal adult male role. They were denied that. They were the first groups who lost the war, so-called. They were rejected by the Americans, and now they're called disabled. And the hard work also helps them prove their masculine identity, their place in our society.
Many Vietnam veterans have said to me that coming home was worse. What they experienced, the lack of being welcomed, of being honored in a way that they saw their fathers get honored. Nobody wanted to talk to them, nobody about what they had done, except to tell them it was wrong. Boys and men who are going off now are willing to put their life on the line for their country. They're willing to do anything our country asks them to do, to save, to do something positive and large and bigger than themselves. And that's what warriors want to do. And these guys came home and felt like it was taken away from them. And that was a terrible wound that, you know, we're not going to give you honor for what you did because we didn't value it. But at the same time, some of them came home and felt, you know, bad about it too, the things they saw and did, or they couldn't understand, you know, for in Vietnam, you know, why did we just lose all these men and then just walk away? How could we do that?
Even the vets coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan are coming home to a horrible economy. So again, they can't get a job and become a head of a household like they should, even though they've gone through the trial by fire, that they can do these things and in a very brave way. And I also find that, I guess it's a general thing, we never, never think of the fact that when we go to war, we're going to have a lot of injured psychologically and physically to take care of. And that's always underestimated.
Mm-hmm. Why do we have such an extreme amount of homelessness among the veteran population, and they have a higher divorce rate and a frequent job changes and even aggressive behavior and spousal abuse in this population?
I think that the VA is doing a lot better job with homelessness. I know they have dedicated a lot of money, a lot of staff. They do a lot of outreach, any place they can find a veteran. And I know that Dr. Szyminski, the head of the VA, has made it his personal mission to not have any homeless vets anymore. You know, he said, we're not going to do that. But after Vietnam, there were tremendous numbers. There still are some. When they come home, if they don't have support, some guys just want to get out so quickly that they don't get processed and channeled into the VA or to the vet center or to the services that are there. And then they discover they can't work because of either an injury or, you know, a physical or psychological injury. I did want to say one other thing. When we talk about post-traumatic stress, anyone who goes through a traumatic experience often experiences post-traumatic stress. They have, you know, these symptoms of where they think about it and they see it happening. Again, if you were in an automobile accident, you might see it over and over again. You might, feel depressed and anxious. It lasts for, you know, sometimes a week, sometimes a month, sometimes a couple months. It's when that these symptoms that are normal for a month or two last 6 months, a year, when 5 years later you're still seeing the same scene, you know, playing over in your head, it's just as terrifying. Mm-hmm. And the same things set you off, the same triggers in the environment. It's like you can't get out of this moment where this terrible thing happened. It's happening again. Mm-hmm. And again. And so, yeah, you know, when this thing happens, you do almost anything to make it go away. One of the things that many people with post-traumatic stress, whether it's soldiers or a woman who's been raped or a person who's been through a terrible event, does is they push it out of their head. They constantly make this effort. I'm not going to think about that. But at the same time, that's what keeps it from healing. They have to be able to think about the entire event, all of it, from the way I felt at the moment emotionally, the sensations I felt, the concepts that are in my head, the self-talk that was going on. But often, and what I've discovered in soldiers in combat, they will say things about themselves that are just false. Men with, you know, silver stars and, you know, bronze stars and purple hearts, and they'll say, you know, I was a coward because I didn't do this or I didn't move. And it's like that, this whole timeline of this year in combat that they had, or 2 years, they did a tremendous number of brave things, but they're stuck in this 1 30-second, you know, period. And that is all they can think about. And so they have to be able to think, you know, be able to look at their whole self and look at what all the factors that went into what happened at that moment.
Mm-hmm. And how does this affect their relationship with their wives and children on an everyday basis?
What I see is that, you know, and this is part of the symptoms of PTSD, regardless, sometimes there's a blunting of emotions. We sometimes say, you know, they have two speeds, you know. They, you know, either they don't have any emotion, and I hear that from spouses. It's like nothing makes him happy. He never smiles. He never looks like he's having a good time. If we go someplace, he's terribly uncomfortable. But the one emotion they have, you know, is anger. They can get very, very, you know, very angry, very fast, and it confuses, the partner who doesn't recognize this person as the same guy that, you know, was laughing at the drive-in and was so much fun, and now he won't go over to her parents' house, and he won't go to the mall, and he won't go to a movie, and he doesn't like any of their friends, and so yeah, it becomes very stressful for them to live with this, and you know they keep hoping it'll get better, and it takes a long time sometimes.
260-452-1185 is the number to call. If you have any questions or comments, you can always post on our Facebook page. Send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio today by my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, as well as Dr. Bruce Nuremberg. He's the head of the PTSD program at the Fort Wayne VA Hospital, as well as Dan Bishton, who is a counselor and a therapist who works with veterans in Fort Wayne. I want to make sure that we localize this as much as possible. I'm sure some of our listeners who maybe don't have vets in their lives are wondering, what does the average person, if there is an average person that walks into the VA hospital here in Fort Wayne, what do they look like? I bet we encounter them in our day to day, but we just don't know it. Dr. Nuremberg, do you want to take that one?
Actually, they look like anybody. if there's any distinguishing features with Vietnam vets, it may be they still have a little 60s look left, and currently, or they have very well-cropped hair. You can usually see that they're very orderly about things. Combat vets were taught that you have to do things at their proper time when they're supposed to be done. So they're also very demanding, and they're impatient because everybody should be doing their job at 100%. Otherwise, people can get hurt.
Will they seek out help at the VA, or does the VA have to perform significant outreach to bring these
The VA does
in?
Both. There's a walk-in clinic that you can walk in. Any veteran can walk in and seek mental health treatment. There's, for the vets coming home, what they call seamless transition at the VA that does both outreach but helps the veteran seek the kinds of treatment he or she needs, whether it's medical or psychiatric, and it's called seamless transition. They have the vet center in Fort Wayne, which was the vet centers were really started by the RAP groups after Vietnam. It's in on Fairfield Avenue in Fort Wayne, and they treat not only the vet; they'll do couple therapy or they'll do family therapy because it can affect the whole family. Mm-hmm. There's also places like the Lutheran Military Veterans and Families Mission that actually does counseling ecumenically, mm-hmm. and it's on its own. They have just a leader who very selflessly is helping vets like herself, because and they work with even the wives of combat soldiers who are having a difficult time here, which is also a group that's not usually taken care of.
We have a couple of folks on the line. I want to make sure that we get to them. We have, looks like Alice on line one. Alice, welcome to Health 360.
Hello there. I'm a survivor of PTSD and dissociative disorder from childhood sexual assault. And I have found that those of us who've learned to survive well may be able to help in a group therapy session for the families and spouses. A lot of people don't understand how to help the victim with triggers, with managing their anger. I think people who have already had their therapy and have made a successful transition back to from victim to survivor could really help families. How do you feel about that?
I think and that right now I'm working for the it's a relatively new program at the VA called the Caregiver Support Program, and there are two programs there that involve to kind of show the awareness that we have that the caregivers of veterans, particularly when we have a lot of veterans with the PTSD, undergo a lot of, it's very stressful. They need support. They need to know about what PTSD is, what to expect, how to manage, how to literally to help their veteran deal, who has the PTSD, deal with what's going on, and being aware of what triggers them, what sets them off. They often feel very isolated. We run a support group for any caregiver on Wednesdays at 5 o'clock, we tell it's going to be a veteran, a caregiver of a veteran.
And that's fine. What I would suggest, uh-huh. just coming from my own therapy sessions, I did find a lot of help from others who had survived the same problems I had.
Right.
But I don't think that it has to be simply someone coming from a veteran situation, but others who have survived PTSD themselves, dissociative disorders, how to manage their triggers. They understand better than most and can possibly teach the families and caregivers a lot about what they're seeing, why it occurs, how to manage their own emotions while trying to help their victim. The transition from victim to survivor is a long one, but right. it can be managed, and I'm living a happy, healthy life with help from others who survived before me.
That's really great.
Thanks for calling in, Alice. And we want to make sure that we get to, I believe Bill is on line two. Bill, welcome to Health 360.
Good afternoon. This question is for both gentlemen. I would like to know about how society views people that have been diagnosed with PTSD, and more succinctly, how the military views that if you've got a mental problem and you go to have it treated, and also how that's been treated in past wars, World War II, maybe even World War I, how the soldiers that were, I think they were diagnosed then as shell-shocked, and how that historically has all been dealt with.
Let's break that down. Some really great points, Bill. Let's start off with some of the misconceptions that folks may have of people that are returning with PTSD. Dr. Nirenberg, do you want to talk about some of those misconceptions that we might have as a society?
Yes, I think that we as a society do not understand what PTSD looks like and what strategies combat vets, when they are home, mm-hmm. have to use to just maintain themselves. As I said, they have to sit at a restaurant, nobody behind them facing the door. If they wake up at night, they check the perimeter, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of times without the lights on. I know somebody who used to, before he went to bed, go out and empty a shotgun in his backyard to make sure that nobody's there.
Mm-hmm.
They can't go into Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they go into Walmart, it has to be very, very, very late at night because they can't control the environment. There's too many people. They can't control the environment. It's scary for them.
But they can look like anybody, really.
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess what I'm asking is, me, the average person, what are some of the thoughts that I might have about somebody who is just returning that are false? What are some of those misconceptions and those prejudices that people are facing when they return?
Well, like they're John Rambo, all of them, or they're ready to go off like a, the military instills a great deal, a strong amount of discipline in these guys, and so they can feel very strong urges to be violent, but they it's very rare that they do.
When I work with the wife of a combat vet,
mm-hmm.
I will try to go through and just explain the behaviors that they never knew what was happening. A combat vet, the emotional spigot is turned off.
Mm-hmm.
Emotional spigot's turned off. They can't talk Hallmark to their wives. They can't talk in intimate, loving words. What they do, though, is they show their love by keeping individuals safe. So they have the perimeter of safety. If you're late getting home, they're really angry, not because they don't trust you, but because you were outside the perimeter of their safety. How would they have gotten to you if something happened to you?
Mm-hmm.
If they don't call. You were supposed to call at 6 o'clock, but Dad, I called at 6:05. It was 6 o'clock, and it's sort of because
combat,
precision is critical, and the vets don't even sometimes know why they're so uptight about certain things, but it does have to do with danger, safety. The sense of safety is very fragile sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know why. I'm going to say they don't know why. Mm-hmm. Explain to a wife when you go into a restaurant in McDonald's, let's say, and the person serving you is taking their time, doesn't look like they're doing what they're doing, and the husband's locked and loaded. The wife is aggravated, the husband's locked and loaded, ready to take him out.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to explain, if somebody's not doing their job, there's danger present, because in Vietnam, somebody wasn't doing their job, everybody could get killed. In basic training, somebody didn't follow through with what they're supposed to do in the drill, everybody got punished.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reflex now. Somebody's not doing their job, and I'm going to get them.
One of the comparisons between World War II and Vietnam was that in World War II, units fought together, stayed together, the officers stayed with their men throughout the duration, and then they had the long trip home, the troop ship from Europe or Asia, where they were allowed to grieve in a communal way, where they could talk about their fallen comrades, compadres, and this was taken away in Vietnam, where guys were whisked in and out individually. The units did not stay together. One could be in Vietnam on Tuesday and back in Wakarusa on Thursday and never have time to grieve. And this is a change that they're recommending now. Keep the units together. Keep the officers who are good leaders with the troops together. Give the troops time to grieve their deceased fallen members.
And with the guard, they're doing that. They come back as a guard unit, and that's a good thing. On the other hand, there's a film out there by John Huston called Let There Be Light, and it details supposedly how they were working with, the psychiatrists were working with World War II vets in psychiatric hospitals, Army psychiatric hospitals, all dedicated to combat fatigue. And it shows the individuals who were coming back at that time and their disorders. The problem was is that it was filmed and premiered in 1946, and it was then confiscated and classified until 1980, when 1980 became, PTSD became legitimate. Somebody didn't want individuals to see what happens. After World War II, we were talking earlier, Major General Smedley Butler has an article online called War's a Racket, and he talks about World War I combat vets who had post-traumatic stress, we call it now, who were in pens and in locked buildings at the hospital in Marion and other hospitals around the country. They had no idea how to treat it. They were they segregated them. And they segregated them after World War I, mostly after World War II. They segregated them. They had domiciliaries or they had psych units. Vietnam vets were the first veterans after Kennedy was president and opened up least restrictive conditions in mental health. So a lot of the state hospitals closed so they could have community-based treatments, even schizophrenia, because they had the medications. So they closed the state hospitals. The Vietnam vets are the first combat vets that were treated outpatient and people saw them. These are the first combat vets that people, and they say they're nuts. Well, no, they always have been in other wars too. This is what post-traumatic stress looks like. And
one thing that I want to make sure that we cover, we only have about 15 minutes left in today's program, and we have some other write-in questions, and they're focused more on treatment and next steps for folks that are in Fort Wayne and need to get to the resources that we have available here. We have one listener who wrote in and said, my grandmother lived in a city in France as a child during World War II, survived bombings there. Today she suffers from depression, has very high anxiety, and has a lot of trouble sleeping. Her doctor has diagnosed her with depression, but I often wonder if this is PTSD. What would the treatments of PTSD be different from treating depression, and are there other methods that could be treating her? Any tips on what she could suggest to guide her doctor?
The treatment for PTSD is improving all the time, and it is what we call exposure therapy, which means that in some way we have to, the person who has been exposed to a terrible event has to be able to think about it in detail, okay, and then help to sort out their feelings and thoughts about it. Now, if somebody who's 89 years old and they push this out, it could be very hard for her to recall. It could be very, very, very painful. But a therapist that she was talking about it and mentioning it, or appeared to be really startled by loud noises. That might be a clue that this is a post-traumatic stress event, because what happens is there's a trigger, and then the person re-experiences the terror or the feeling they had at that event. Mm-hmm. This is sort of a shout out, for people around 4th of July and New Year's. Many vets, are very sensitive to the sound of fireworks, and they'll say that, I can handle it on the day, but what bothers them a great deal is when they don't expect it, and there's a loud crap, boom, and the fireworks we have right now. And so if you have a vet in your neighborhood that is, he's a combat vet, or he's come back, blowing fireworks off is not a great way to celebrate for him. Okay.
Yeah, Dr. Narenberg, there's been a discussion of psychotherapy for PTSD, including cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive processing therapy, prolonged exposure therapy, as Dan just referred to, eye movement desensitization, reprocessing, and of course, group therapy. And as Alice, our caller, pointed out, group therapy with others, other combat vets who have experienced what they have experienced. As someone said, only the vets can help treat themselves together because they can trust each other. What are the modes of therapy that you find most effective that you're using today?
At RVA, we use cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive processing therapy, and exposure therapy. I think in their different ways, and group therapy, with medication management. And I think the medications are going to be might be a little different if there's post-traumatic stress or a stress reaction versus simple depression. I believe underlying all the different therapies are a couple common principles. One is attempting to reunite these horrific memory events with the emotions that occurred during them. Because during combat in particular, it don't mean nothing. Don't mean anything. They shut off the emotional spigot. It's never really turned back on. They accept their own death. That's the only way of dealing with combat is accepting your own death. So you're dead. Who's going to bring you back to life? I mean, you change clothes, you come home. So there's this lack of emotion. What they have to do is reattach that emotion. Exposure therapy can do it in one way. Cognitive processing does it in another way. But it's still that closing of that, owning it, making it part of you. I can tell you about scary events when I was in school. But if I were a Vietnam combat vet, I don't want to talk about that. It's not part of my life. I don't own those feelings.
Another question that I want to get to before our program ends, just in about 10 minutes. Beth writes in and says, a husband of a friend has many of the symptoms of PTSD that you are describing, including beginnings of some spousal abuse. He was a pilot for the U.S. military during our response to Iraq's invasion in Kuwait. He is now a pilot for a major commercial airline. His wife is concerned that if the VA gets involved with his treatment, his job would somehow be jeopardized. Can you respond to that? Is that true? Is that another misconception?
The VA has got very, you know, very strong policies about confidentiality. If he's with a commercial airline, I don't know how they would get the record if he didn't release it. And now, you know, sometimes, you know, they could, I suppose, the company could say, this is a condition, you release this information to, you know, our company doctors, so we can see if you're okay. But the VA often works with, you know, the veterans. They're very, very protective. We've been told, you know, your records there are safe. You know, as long as you don't release them, we're not going to release them. I would encourage him to get help. And if he does want to come to the VA, he can go to the vet center. The vet center, there's a firewall between the VA and the vet center. If you're a combat veteran, if you've been, you know, and that's, you know, there's certain definitions we have. If you served at a certain time and place, and you're a combat veteran, you can go to the vet center. And no one at the VA can see anything from the vet center unless there's a release form. They can look at our notes. They're part of, they're paid by the VA administration. Mm-hmm. But you know,
it's really confidential.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And
nobody can get a hold of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
The use of medication is very interesting because it's been pointed out that we have built into our physiology the flight or fight mechanism where adrenaline is released and other hormones and neurotransmitters that really give us that ability to respond rapidly with extreme strength and sharpness and acuity. But the body is intended to do this over a brief period of time, and it's been stated that with prolonged PTSD, moral injury, this hyper adrenaline response continues, and some of these vets apparently have been helped by beta blocker drugs that can block the adrenaline, as well as antidepressants. How often do you use medication, and how effective is medication in conjunctive with your psychotherapy?
Personally, I consult with the psychiatrist and have the veterans I work with see psychiatrists. The medications, on the one hand, provide a safety net so they don't spiral down, the veteran doesn't spiral down too far. If they can't get out of bed or if they're so depressed they can't think, therapy's not going to work at all. Also, I think that it's good to moderate that stress level, the cortisol that's released because it's very destructive of body tissue. So you want to minimize that as well. And we note that a lot of combat vets have a lot of physical ailments, likely partly due to that. I mean, there's also with Vietnam vets the Agent Orange. But I like the focus also with both psychiatry and psychotherapy working in conjunction with each other. I would really hope that the medications could lessen. I mean, there's a good medication, prazosin, that works for about 60% of vets, takes away nightmares and some of the flashbacks. That's great. But we want to heal them. That's not healing them. That's just, again, covering the symptoms and allowing them to be coped with. But that's not what caused the problem. The problem was caused by horrific events, moral injuries, character destruction.
Yeah, sometimes, the medicines can be helpful for a veteran in therapy because he can take, a mild, a low dose of Valium or Xanax, or a very low dose prior to sessions, which can be extremely stressful. We don't want them to depend on them, but it can help them to talk about an event that otherwise would be very difficult to talk about. So,
the book that was not mentioned was Jonathan Shay's second book called Odysseus in America, the subtitle of which is Combat Trauma and the Trials of Homecoming. And he uses the model because it took Odysseus, after the Trojan War, 10 years to get home. He had to go deal with the Cyclops and the Scylla and Charybde, and at one point had to go to hell and back, Hades. And it took him 10 years to get home, and he's the only one on that ship that survived. And that's the metaphor for how long homecoming can be, even in the Trojan War.
And what can our communities and families do to help these returning veterans best reintegrate in a comfortable way back into their families and local society?
You know, one of the things, our economy has changed so much, and the veterans in prior times could work in jobs that allowed them a certain amount of isolation. They didn't have to worry about people. They were on an assembly line, or they did construction or contract. They felt they had some control over their space. And now, jobs like working, behind a counter, a veteran who's trying to get a job, you didn't have people just walk in up to you. People in combat, or when they were in country in Iraq or Afghanistan, you didn't let people just walk right up to you, behind you, and people reaching into their pocket was a bad sign. And if you're standing at a cashier, that's just, or stuck someplace, unarmed, those are jobs that are difficult. So, employers should recognize that vets need sometimes a job that is, allows them, to have some more control over their environment, at times, a place where they can feel safe, and putting them right in public, or a place where they're surrounded by people.
My work with veterans is to have individuals around you who understand. So I ask them to bring their wife in, and I say, look, when the sky's going off on the person wants to kill the person at McDonald's who's not doing his job, don't say don't do that. Don't discount the feeling. The feeling is real. You can say, I understand why you're feeling angry, because the person's not doing their job, and in Vietnam, that would have got somebody killed. I understand why you feel that way, but this isn't Vietnam. But I understand, and you keep meeting the person where they're at. You don't discount their feeling. Their feeling is very real, whether it's based on something good or not. I understand how you feel, but this isn't the situation where it's going to happen. Now, you're right, he should be doing his job, but nothing deadly is going to come of it. But I understand where this comes from. In Vietnam or in Iraq or in Afghanistan, somebody might have got killed. But this is not that, and you slowly work. And that's why it's important. I don't think you tune up in therapy. It's kind of like a car. You don't tune up one cylinder. You have to tune up everybody around it.
And it's been stated that while we've had difficulty accepting the returning Vietnam vets, I think people are doing a better job now in honoring our returning combat veterans. You can hate the war, but honor and love the soldier. And I believe the most important thing, too, is listen to them. And after Vietnam, people didn't want to hear about it. And they mm-hmm. forced these soldiers to wall themselves off. And now, if they have a narrative, listen to it. And, of course, in therapy, you have that opportunity. But even at home or at church or in the restaurant, let them talk. Let them say what they wish.
Right.
On top of that, understand that those behaviors that are so problematic, periods of the year when around January, I feel really bad all the time. You know, I'm feeling down, Doc, you know, this past month. I don't know why. Look back to Vietnam or Iraq. Look back for anniversary events, things that are behind it. Don't just assume that this person's a bad person. There's always a reason for it. With combat vets, I look back to combat anniversaries. I look to who might have died. What bad battle did they fight? What traumatic event happened? We always do that and look back. And then as they become aware of it too, they can then own it. I know in January I'm going to feel bad, so let's hold off on me, and I'm going to try to deal with it. I'm going to own it. I'm going to make it part of my life rather than simply push it away.
We have just about a minute and a half left in today's program, and I want to make sure that we list off some of the resources locally that you all have the information for that folks listening may be interested in using, and not only those that may be suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, but also those who are living with people that have that disorder and are trying to be supportive. We don't want to forget about them as well. So, Dan, do you want to maybe list some of those resources one more time for our listening audience before we say goodbye today?
First off, we want every veteran to know that the VA has services for you, and there are a great many services that many veterans don't know about, particularly Vietnam veterans who didn't, use the program. We're having, a lot of new people, not only the new vets, but the older vets coming in. We have a caregiver, like I said, I'm in the caregiver support program. Mm-hmm. And so we are taking if you're a caregiver of a vet who needs your assistance, we have programs and services that can help you.
There's also a crisis line, Veterans Crisis Line.
Yeah.
And I don't know where we could keep the number, but it's 1-800-273-8255, and it's press 1 for veterans. It's confidential help for veterans and their families. Again, there's the Fort Wayne Vet Center on Fairfield Avenue, and the number is 260-460-1456. There's also, as I said, a number of community-based help centers, Lutheran Military Veterans and Families Ministries, and it can be called at 260-755-2239.
Great. Thank you both so much for joining. I hate to cut you off, but it's that time. We're almost on 1 o'clock. And this is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 HD Channel 1. We're streaming online at nipr.fm. This is WBOY Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. Coming up on 1 o'clock, and Fresh Air is up next. This episode of Midday Matters Health 360 will be podcasted by the end of the day at nipr.fm.